Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Food trucks are more popular than ever in Columbus, where you can find a kitchen on wheels serving almost anything from the usual hot dogs and burgers to gourmet cuisine. But the trend really started with the taco trucks, and those started with immigrants. A new documentary film tells the story of taco trucks in Columbus. The film is called Transfusion, and it shows how some in the city at first did not want taco trucks in their neighborhood.
They're not investing in the community. They're throwing up the cheapest possible building, making the largest possible profit, and getting out as quickly as possible. That is not going to help us.
That's a West Side resident, a critic of the trucks at the time, from the film Transfusion. It will be shown this Saturday, May 11th at 4 p.m. at the Gateway Film Center. For more information, we'll have a link for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now is the director of the film, Robert Lemon. Robert has a master's degree in city and regional planning from OSU, as well as a master's in landscape architecture from the University of California, Berkeley. And he's currently completing his PhD in geography at the University of Texas at Austin, where he examines the role food plays in shaping social behavior and urban policy in cities. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Bonita Lee. Bonita, who's featured in the film, is a retired community liaison with the city. Welcome to the show, Bonita.
Hi, thanks.
Robert, from what I was told, you were going to do a film about taco trucks in several cities. But you stopped and decided to focus on Columbus. What set Columbus apart for you in that way?
Well, seeing taco trucks in Ohio is, for me, having lived most of my life in California and in Texas, is a little odd, and I moved to Columbus, Ohio from Mexico. I was in Mexico for about a year, and then I came to Columbus, and I started working with Bonita Lee for the community department for the city of Columbus, Department of Development. And she would take me out to show me some of the issues they were having with the taco trucks, and they had a lot of there was a lot of controversy around them at the time in 2004. I looked at it when I was in planning school here from a pretty standard planning perspective, but as I went and did my master's at Cal in design, I started looking at it from a design perspective, but it just added more questions to me about, you know, where are people coming from, where are their practices, and I decided that I would write my PhD on it as well, or do my dissertation on it as well. And I came back, I started doing filmmaking a few years ago, and I thought, well, I'll do a short in each of the cities I study, and Columbus will be one of them because I'm interested in how the perception has changed in the last 8 years. And I know that I know more or less what was happening, so it would be a little easier for me to write about, and I knew Bonita. So I thought I could do a short around Bonita and the food trucks. And then I met Lydia, and I met this truck on in the King Lincoln district, of which people seemed very grateful for and were very enthused about. And I thought, well, that would be another short, and I'll do two shorts. And then I said, well, Lydia has given me a lot of access, and I talked more with Lydia. I said, am I able to go to Mexico and stay with your family and film? And she goes, oh, sure, no problem. I said, can we talk about issues of immigration? She was, sure, no problem. I said, well, then I think I can do three more shorts around you and do five shorts and do all my time in Columbus making this film, forget the other cities as far as film is concerned, and then have each of these shorts build into a feature where there's character development. And another part of it is I teach a lot urban geography, and I wanted to fold this into my lectures. So as I made the film, I'm constantly thinking, how can I fold this into some of the more difficult concepts I have to teach my students? So I put them into modules that you could actually each segment of the film stand alone and get something from it.
My guest is Robert Lemon. He's the writer and director of Transfusion. It's a new documentary. It's going to be shown one time only for now on Saturday at Gateway Film Center. So if you want to know more about that, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. It's about the taco trucks and the culture in Columbus. Also with us is Bonita Lee. She's a retired neighborhood liaison for the city of Columbus. Robert M. Bonita, you know, jump in, Bonita, as you see fit, is let's start by explaining why and where taco trucks started in Columbus in the first place. What do we know about the inception? Bonita?
I believe that it came with the people. And all of a sudden, it seemed that along Georgesville Road and Sullivan, that these trucks were appearing, and I think nobody quite knew how to take it. So we would get calls about it, and you know,
in the health department or in the
at my office, you know, are they legal and do they have licenses, and I will say yes that they do all of those things and follow the rules as everyone else did at the time. They also had to have some kind of a zoning clearance to place it, you know, and, you know, get a site plan and show where they were going to put the truck and all that sort of thing. And I'm not sure now, since I'm retired, what all the requirements are. But
well, there's a new set. There's a new pilot project starting up in June. A 7-month pilot program will begin aimed at establishing new rules for food trucks in Columbus. Mm-hmm. Robert, the man in the clip that we heard at the beginning of the program was critical of the taco trucks, which is what they were. They weren't. This is one not the food, the groovy food scene we're talking about now. But these were the taco trucks on the west side. They had a lot of misconceptions about the taco truck entrepreneurs. What were their misconceptions?
Well, Joe Sway in the film speaks a lot about that. That's a question I had that I asked Joe Sway Vicente, who's head of the Hispanic Coalition, mm-hmm. and he had to work a lot with the neighborhood when they first moved in. Of course, they thought, you know, they're not necessarily the most attractive thing, and that goes for anywhere. And that's really what my dissertation focuses on is this cultural aesthetic mm-hmm. that we've become associated with, and it's different. And you can look at the trucks, and this is where things get fuzzy, because some will look at the trucks and not like them for their appearance, and it may not be a racial thing, but it can be interpreted that way, and then that's when conflict happens between people as misunderstandings of cultural transgressions. But some of the things where they weren't sure if they were paying electricity, they didn't think the immigrants paid taxes. There were some legitimate concerns about some trash that people would eat there and not throw their trash away. And in going around and talking with most taco truck owners, there is a little bit of everything, of course. There are people who don't have their trash, but today they do, and it was a process of educating people from Mexico what they need to have, as well as understanding that not all the trash is coming from the Mexican population either. Most of the trash is there already. It just now becomes associated with someone moving
now
in.
Now there's someone there to blame
so,
it on.
Yeah, so now it's not black and white, this or the other. There are, you know, several factors, and there is some truth and fiction to all of it.
There's a neighborhood commission there, of course. This was an issue that they brought up, and when they went out and investigated it, they found that, no, they are paying their electric bills. They're actually paying a lot of money to park their vehicles in the lots or wherever they're paying, parking them. They're paying very much their fair share of taxes and that kind of thing. So, Bonita, in the end, what did the Hilltop community decide? How did they resolve this?
Well, actually, at the time that I was there, the discussion was going on.
Okay.
And a complete resolution didn't come. But I know that a lot of the focus was that, you know, it was going to bring property values. And you have to understand, the Hilltop has been through a lot. They lost a lot when they lost a lot of those industrial jobs that were there. Westinghouse was so big. I mean, the Hilltop was a very prosperous area, excuse me, and people had jobs, and the housing was full of families, you know. And now you're looking at the devastation of a lot of loss of industry, housing going down, a lot of housing vacancy, and then they look and they say, here comes something else that's going to knock our property values down. And so, I kind of go with Robert that it's not all about race, but a lot of it is about fear of loss of what they have.
And it was something new. So what did the Hilltop community eventually decide? I mean, are there still struggles with this, Robert, or have they resolved to some extent?
It seems to me most of it has been resolved. I think they're fairly welcome in the community, especially as food trucks in general in the city of Columbus has been embraced. It's helped the Mexican population, and now it's a cool thing to go explore the west side and eat at the trucks and go to the neighborhood. But I think there's always going to be a brick-and-mortar conflict. This is kind of, a taco truck can be down the street from a business or a restaurant, and there's always a conflict that they're stealing their customers. It's this new, innovative mobile truck that moves in. This is kind of like, for me, it's synonymous of Netflix wiping out Blockbuster. Hmm. You know, someone finds a new idea based on what's available but I think there's also a different market. I think when the trucks first came in, they were just targeting the Mexican population eating.
That wanted to eat decent
Mexican
food.
And it's basically in 2004, it's mainly single men, immigrants coming here to work. They didn't have a family with them. They needed cheap, fast food and a place where they could feel comfortable, speak Spanish, eat something familiar to them. So it's about their identity. Now you're seeing families moving in, and most of the men I did talk to in 2004 when I was looking at the issue, most of the immigrants here told me they were only going to be here for a few years, save money, and they planned on moving back to Mexico. Talking to them now,
everybody says that when they move
to
Columbus.
Yes, exactly. talking to them now,
we love
Columbus. We're not
that.
Leaving. But talking to them now, they realize they may not be able to go home. Now they have family here, and they're putting down roots, and that becomes a new issue. If we have immigrant populations putting down roots that aren't necessarily legal, technically quote unquote legal citizens, then something has to be addressed in that realm.
We'll get into that issue with Robert Lemon. He's writer and director of Transfusion. It's a new documentary. It will be shown this Saturday at the Gateway Film Center. You can get more information about that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also with us, Bonita Lee, a retired neighborhood liaison for the city of Columbus, who features prominently in the film. We'll continue talking about that and another neighborhood in the city that the taco trucks headed to and had a very different experience. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
The Great Gatsby hits theaters on Friday with more cars, clothes, and parties than most any other movie you can think of.
It's like if you took every image, in a luxury fashion magazine and scrambled them all together and blew them up to big screen size and put them in 3D and filled them with movie stars and a big soundtrack.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The reality of art imitating life for both the rich and the poor next time on Marketplace from APM.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 89.7 NPR News is your source for local news, public affairs reporting, and NPR News. Listen for news on 89.7 FM and at WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides. In June, a new seven-month pilot program will begin. It's aimed at establishing new rules for food trucks in Columbus. When Robert Lemon was filming his new documentary about the taco truck culture in Columbus, there were few rules, and that made it even more confusing for the proprietors, who were mainly Latino immigrants who still struggled with the language. This hour, we're talking about Robert Lemon's new film, Transfusion, which combines the story of the Columbus taco truck scene with the issues of race and immigration that go with it. One proponent of the trucks on the East Side is a lawyer and East Side resident, John Waddy, who is also featured in the film.
There's more to the taco truck. There are people working on the taco truck, and they have their own lives and their own histories. And people need to really look behind, and I guess that's true about anything in life. If you don't take the time to look at what you've got and who people are, you're going to miss a big part of life.
One segment of the film before it turned over to the King Lincoln District and the taco truck scene there included a little tour of sorts that Bonita Lee, you gave of a neighborhood on the west side that at one point eventually was pretty much shattered by the 2004 arson-related deaths of 10 people in an apartment complex. And tell us what you were thinking as you explored that that abandoned neighborhood, and Robert, also what you were thinking about including that in the film.
The Lincoln Park tragedy, it just cuts to the core of sadness and loss and injustice and so many things. I mean, that's a whole nother show. When you look at housing issues, the kinds of challenges that people are having as they immigrate here, they don't know anything about Columbus. Sometimes they have people come up and say they'll rent them something, and it's a house that's empty, and the person doesn't own it, and they're collecting money from them. I mean, they really get the short end of the stick a lot of the time. And that's just really putting it mildly. I don't even like that I said that like that. It's heartbreaking. And when you look at not only there on the west side, but in other areas of the city where you have immigrants coming and trying to find housing that they can afford, it's the trailer parks, the man's trailer park was in the news. Oh gosh, I can't remember what year that was, and it had to have been shortly after the fires. But they're living in trailers that they're renting, or sometimes they buy and then they have to pay to be there. And there were just so many problems that rose up, and drainage problems, lots of mosquitoes there because water standing, and then so many children around. Mm. And the effects are, you know, we have to look at a whole lot more in as far as how people are treated when they come here. Just because some folks don't want to see immigrants here, I don't think that there's any right to treat people unjustly, but they don't come. They don't complain. Mm-hmm. You rarely see it.
Robert, how did this play a role in the story you were telling?
Well, we went back and forth cutting it in and out the fire because we wanted that not to dominate the film. That wasn't the main issue of the film. Obviously, we wanted to keep it about food and taco trucks, but as we looked at the city of Columbus as an entity. The city itself is a character, and we wanted to build the city character up in part one of the film and how people relate to immigrants in terms of the city. But it was also a part of, yes, an environmental discrimination, not just meaning clean air and water, soil, but the environment being also the built environment, not having things up to code, taking advantage of people's rents. These are also important things in environmental discrimination. And you see this a lot throughout the country where any immigrant population moves in that's not quote unquote legal. They don't want to speak out if there's an issue. Things are not always up to code, being taken advantage of rents. So is an environmental discrimination a problem of housing?
You do spend some time as well describing how the King Lincoln District came to its present condition, and why why was that important to explain?
Well, this again the course I teach, and we talk about environmental discrimination, and that this kind of feeds into one issue, environmental discrimination with the housing, and two, environmental discrimination with a freeway in the 60s that was put, Highway 71, that cut off the King Lincoln District from downtown. And it's important to give some historical aspect to that neighborhood and the fact that it's a spatial issue, and everything in the film tries to relate back to the issue of space and where you're located within the city. But a particular time when the freeway cut off the King Lincoln District from downtown, and it went into a downward spiral economically, which suffocated the social condition of the neighborhood, and not having the restaurants and its isolation from the rest of the city and how it's trying to build itself back up. That was an important reason to tie that in.
John Waddy, who is, again, featured in the film, and we heard from him earlier, said that brought up the issue of how the food trucks fit into the King Lincoln District. And Bonita, you live near the east side, near King Lincoln neighborhood, where for the most part residents have embraced the arrival of a taco truck. So what's the difference between the west side and the east side when it comes to the taco trucks?
Gee, I don't know. Individuals, attitudes. I know that the east side has always been an area that embraces everyone. I have never, in all the time that I've lived there, and I've most of my life been there, and my aunts lived right around the corner from where the taco truck sits, my great-grandparents. My mother grew up, and my father grew up right in that neighborhood as well. And just through generations, it's we've had to stick together. And I think that the east side is less divisive.
Well, they mentioned to Robert that it's something of a food desert, too.
Yes. Well, the definition of the food desert is that there's nowhere to get healthy food, essentially. But it hadn't been tightly defined, that term, as far as a spatial issue is how far you need to go to get food or how quickly you need to get there, transit routes. So, but speaking is if I can go down the block and get something to eat, then it would be, in my definition, a food desert, yes. It's building up. There are some new places over there. There's a Cajun kitchen or a Creole kitchen, and some other good places to eat at. But yes, the truck itself, and there's a little story that the film doesn't talk about because there's no time to get into, but Homeport worked with Lydia to move her from the west side to the east side. They talked with John Waddy about bringing the food truck in, and he thought he would give it a shot, try it out. So they brought the truck over, and he was like, I've never seen such a thing before. You know, I didn't know they had big kitchens in here and they can cook this wonderful food from Mexico. He said this, you know, so when he first saw it, you know, he didn't realize that there are any trucks on the west side, and one parks on his property on the east side. And he seemed to fall in love with it right away as a way that, okay, now I can get people sitting on the street corner. And he's very much a Jane Jacobs kind of person, eyes on the street. So having people sitting on the street corner eating is a positive thing for him.
In one of the last scenes of the film, it shows Lydia, the owner of the taco truck featured in the film, meeting with an immigration lawyer trying to figure out a path to citizenship. She hasn't seen her family back in Mexico in about a decade. Joining us now is Columbus immigration lawyer Dennis Muchnicki. Welcome to the show, Dennis.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. For people like Lydia, who's featured in the documentary we've been talking about, who own a business and have been here for many years, are they any better off when it comes to immigration, or are we in such a purgatory about immigration right now because of what's going on in Washington?
Well, her ownership of the business doesn't give her any specific preference in immigration. Her long-term residency could help her out if she was caught and put into deportation, perhaps. But neither one of those factors, standing alone under the current system, entitles her to anything.
Are there any good options right now for undocumented people like Lydia, who are entrepreneurs and definitely have roots in the community now?
None of the options would focus on her entrepreneurial status. The options now would focus on family connections to people who are legally here, parents, a spouse, children, and mainly spouse and children.
And
the way it stands now, under the current system, the family tie is pretty much the only thing that helps her out, if that family tie exists.
The Gang of Eight immigration bill working its way through Washington right now, is there any hope in there for someone like Lydia?
Yes.
What? Like what?
Well, that will create a track, which seems to get some conservative support, is a torturously long track. But at least it creates a potential path that will stretch over a decade for her to eventually get a green card. Now, and it would also give her kind of an quasi-legal status during that time where she could get a work authorization, a Social Security number, and she wouldn't have to fear being arrested or deported or anything like that while she waits for her opportunity to move up in the line to get a green card. So, yeah, it would have the current bill would have a big effect on someone like her.
Robert Lemon, there is a story she tells in the film about where the police or the ICE,
Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Thanks. I'm too conditioned to say it the other way now.
It's what runs through their veins.
Right. So, where they show up, but they're kind of rounding people up, and Lydia hides.
Well,
or runs away.
I think she was walking out of a store shopping, and there are many Mexicans at the store shopping, and this is, of course, her account of the story.
That's accurate with some of the things we've heard.
Yes.
That literally ICE picks neighborhoods, and they do sweeps.
And she tells me of a sweep in her story, and she said that she was just missed by a few feet when they were rounding people up, and she started walking the opposite direction as quickly as possible and made it around the corner and got in her car. But she said she was so terrified that she couldn't drive home because her knees were shaking so much that she had to call her daughter to come pick her up and take her home.
And again, that sounds consistent with things we've heard from clients in our law office.
Dennis Muchnicki, what sense do we have about how many people like Lydia are out there in the Central Ohio area?
Probably
now?
Over 100,000. So 100, easily 75,000, probably closer to 100,000.
Robert Lemon, I'll tell you the truth. One of my favorite parts of the film is when you do go to Mexico and visit Lydia's family. I love, you know, their everything about it. I mean, the colors. I think it's really interesting how you show the different kinds of graffiti, the different kinds of wall art in the two cities. And that there's lots of stuff and lots of interesting moments. But her family especially, and you get a sense by being able to see when she talks about missing her family, she's not just talking about missing her family. You can see why she misses her family now.
Yes, her family is quite dynamic. Going down there, she was telling me, "Oh, no problem." I said, "Well, have you talked to your family yet about me filming?" She said, "No, but you can go down there." And I was like, "Well, call them first before I fly all the way, knock on your parents' door."
And where did you go? Where in Mexico are they?
It's San Luis Potosí.
Okay.
It's north central. It's currently having a lot of drug issues. There's another issue I had filming down there, but doesn't make it into the film. That's another story. But going down there and meeting with her parents was quite nice. They were very accepting and following them around town, and also filming around the city was nice. People, I've lived about 2 years of my life in Mexico, so going down there wasn't a big stretch. Filming was the stretch for me personally, seeing how much I could film. And I was surprised that even with the camera, there is friendly.
Even when the police were around.
Even when the police were around, they're as friendly as, you know, as I remember living there. Uh-huh. People are very kind in Mexico.
And in the film as well, you did a split screen, and it really illustrated in ways that I'm not sure how else you would do it. How connected what Lydia does here, how connected it is to what she came from in Mexico.
Yes, there's a lot of cultural practices, especially in food, and this tradition or this practice or performance, rather, of eating on the street. It's brought with them to the United States. It's almost like there's this, as she says in the film, it transports you. It's like you go to a taco truck and you feel like you're standing in Mexico. It's a way to bring home to where you're at. And it's done through food and the preparation of food and the aesthetics and the space itself around the truck is a way to bring this whole feeling of, it's almost like going to Universal Studios and they put you in the movie, but you go to a taco truck, it puts you back in Mexico.
You're actually showing, I think it's her sister making a certain kind of taco.
Yes.
And then Lydia doing the exact same thing.
That's correct. That's the climax of the film. So
sorry.
That's
spoiler
okay.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. But there's a highlight in where we do a split screen where Lydia is making tacos rojos, which is a traditional meal that her family makes. And it's very traditional to San Luis Potosí, Mexico. And you see her sister and her mother preparing the exact same meal, and you see the two of them side by side telling you what goes in the food, how to prepare the food, and sometimes there are these moments where it's like they're talking to each other, but they're not together.
Dennis Muchnicki, just real quickly, there is the new pilot program for the food trucks rolling out in June, and I was wondering if you have any sense about how the new pilot program might affect the immigrant food truck vendors.
I have a hunch that that program per se isn't going to have any specific impact.
Okay.
My biggest concern would be, again, whether the ICE agents use that as a way to lead them to illegals who are vending. So that would be my biggest concern. And that's going to be a matter of ICE discretion. I mean, you have to remember, the Columbus ICE office is one of the most aggressive offices in the United States. I mean, they go out after people. They're a tough office to deal with.
Wow.
It's not unforeseen that they could use programs like that, see who's registering, et cetera, and follow up on them.
Well, I thank you, Dennis Muchnicki, for talking with us today about this. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Dennis Muchnicki, he's an immigration lawyer at the firm Muchnicki & Bittner in Columbus. And also, Bonita Lee, thank you for joining us to talk about the film today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bonita Lee is in the film. She's a retired neighborhood liaison for the city of Columbus, and Robert Lemon, writer and director of Transfusion. Robert, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you very much for bringing me in. It's been fun.
The film Transfusion, written and directed by Robert Lemon, will be shown this Saturday, May 11th, at the Gateway Film Center at 4 p.m. For more information, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. When we return, we're going to talk about infant mortality rates in the minority community and how folks are working to improve those. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know. That's the opening lines of Clara Massoud's new novel, The Woman Upstairs. It's about a single woman who hasn't fulfilled her dream of being an artist and a mother. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Massoud, who also wrote the bestseller, The Emperor's Children. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Major news outlets used to refer to some people as illegal aliens. But nowadays,
the undocumented immigrants have
millions
made it
of illegal here. Immigrants
millions
living
undocumented in immigrants.
The illegal immigrant from Mexico.
They're reflecting what's happening in society. We're trying to sort out how to think about these people.
The media, immigration, and semantics later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Bethel Dental Care, providing general dentistry from pediatrics to geriatrics in a comfortable atmosphere. A proud supporter and promoter of WOSU programming. More information at 614-451-0341 or online at BethelDentalCare.com.
Sustaining givers are the future of 89.7 NPR News. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio's infant mortality rate of nearly 8 deaths per 1,000 births easily exceeds the national rate of 6.75%, and the disparities between whites and African Americans are stark. The 2009 rate for whites is 6.4 and the rate for African Americans 14.2. Joining us now to talk about a program created to address this issue and the causes is Grace Kalisua. Grace is program manager at Columbus Public Health, where she directs the day-to-day operation of the agency's Caring for Two. It's a federal Healthy Start project established to improve those outcomes. Welcome to the show, Grace.
Thank you, Ann, for having me here.
Also joining us is Tanya Fulwider. She's program director of PALM, which stands for Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms. It's a program of Mental Health America of Franklin County and a partner with the Caring for Two project. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Ann.
PALM, typically we've talked with PALM before, we talked with you before, Tonya. It's typically aimed at women going through postpartum depression and maternal-related depressions.
Correct.
Tomorrow night, I'll be part of the cast in a dramatic reading of Momologues 2, Off to School, a performance brought to you. It's a one-night-only performance brought to you by PALM. For more information, you can check out a link to PALM at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Grace, let's talk about the problem. First, why are African-American babies dying at twice the national rate? What's happening?
And we can say it's related to several factors, both medical factors and non-medical factors that we refer to as social determinants of health. And so one of the things at Columbus Public Health is that this program, being a federal program, is to look at those issues. And we have contributors of infant mortality, which we know to be preterm births, baby being born too early, too small, weighing low, and then maternal complications, as well as sudden infant death syndrome, certain babies dying unexpectedly. And so we have those factors. And for African-American mothers, we look at those issues that are non-medical, such as low income, poverty, exposure to complications and stuff, that they don't have money and living wages and that to be able to provide those things that they need access to health care. And one of the things that Caring for Two is to support the increase of access to health care. And so we seek out and do outreach for those mothers mm-hmm. to be able to get to care early.
So that maternal complication rate is lowered.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And so that their babies are born but more at the right time, healthier weights, healthier overall, right?
Yes. Yes.
Tanya Fulwider, why the collaboration with PALM?
Well, we work with the Caring for Two program on
their local health system initiative. So beyond the direct services that they're providing, the amazing and valuable and effective direct services they provide to the Caring for Two Moms, as a Healthy Start program, they're also charged with impacting the local health system. And we know that maternal depression, both prenatally and postpartum, is a significant and common factor. I mean, it's more common than any other time in a woman's life.
Across the board.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So in pregnancy and postpartum, mm-hmm. Mental health disorders are more common than any other time in a woman's life. So what we're talking about is this complication that impacts the health of the maternal child relationship. And, you know, it impacts her ability to be successful as a mother, untreated. And so we work with the Caring for Two program to help the local health system improve. So we talk to providers about screening, talking to moms when they're pregnant, screening them during pregnancy and postpartum. We educate them on what the POEM program does to support their work. So we're helping the Caring for Two program in the local health system influencing care for moms that way.
Listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking about the Caring for Two program. It's out of the Columbus City Health Department. If you have a question or comment for us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Grace Kalisawa, you're with the Columbus Public Health Department. You direct the Caring for Two program. When we talk about depression and that sort of a thing, maternal depression, how do they screen for that? Is that something that you were looking for before, or did that just start with POEM?
No, that's one of our core service functions that we provide. We provide in-home service case management, refer, and help moms to get on services, to link them to services such as WIC or Medicaid.
How much are moms willing to do that when it comes to something like depression? Because a lot of times for a lot of people, there's stigma associated with it. It's hard for them to understand, you know, even what's happening. Tanya, we've talked about it before. You don't even realize it's happening half the time. True. You're pregnant. Mm-hmm. Doesn't everybody feel this way when you're pregnant, that kind of a thing? So how do you break through that? What are you saying to them, and what are they telling you that is helping you do that?
Well, one of the things we do, we have a screening, and we do screen prenatally and postnatally, and we screen our moms. And the forms that we use and we do in the screening, we tell them, this is to look at where your health is, so do the overall health screening. And so our public health nurses and social workers will do those screenings. And one of the things that Tanya didn't tell you how we link with POEM is that about 3 years ago, we formed the Maternal Depression Task Force.
Okay.
And Tanya was brought in such a vast experience and her personal story to this group. And we were able to form the Franklin County Depression Task Force, looking at and exploring resources and the needs of pregnant women in our community. And that task force has been going on for 3 years, and we have done a tremendous amount of work developing a resource book that we call A Handy Guide for Mom, and we use it in the hospital. So representatives on that task force is from all hospitals as well as social service agencies.
Are the clients, the people that you work with, sometimes surprised to hear that, you know, we think that you're suffering from depression, and we think that you could use some other kind of help besides just getting your blood pressure taken and checking, you know, other kinds of physical things?
Yeah, we have to be smart about it, and because the stigma that is attached to that, as you said earlier, because our moms, when they feel, they always say, I'm not crazy. And so our staff is trained to be able to say, we want to explore further your health. And this is sort of a test that we will be able to see where you are. And the unique thing about what we have done at Columbus Public Health Caring for Two is to engage an in-home counselor with an agency.
So when we in-home
counselor.
Okay.
So we contracted for in-home counselor when we realized the analysis from our depression screening rated high for our mom's symptoms for depression. And
in-home counselor being, that's going to be much more likely that they're going to actually get the treatment they need.
Absolutely. There are so many barriers to getting treatment, whether it's the stigma of you know, asking for that help, whether it's having young children and being, you know, how do I get out of the house?
Transportation.
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to put all the kids on the bus to go see a counselor. So that is a wonderful example of meeting moms where they are and getting them what they need.
This must be pretty exciting for you in a way. It really broadens your reach. Poem, you know, started out pretty middle class, kind of band of women who could afford to even figure out and had the resources to do something about what they were suffering with.
Mm-hmm. And we really feel that our phone mentoring program, sometimes I never meet some of these moms face to face because of all the barriers, but sometimes it's like, even our mentors will say they feel like they've known them for years. And there's that connection that whether they're across the city or across the state, they understand.
You started Poem because you struggled with postpartum depression yourself. Mm-hmm. Do you hear yourself sometimes? Do you remember when you're talking with people? You're smiling now, but I mean, sometimes you go, I remember.
Oh, absolutely. Part of it is that I can still connect, even though my kids are 15 and 12, but they're saying the same things. And part of that is a strength because I can connect still. And part of it makes me a little sad that we haven't progressed further, that sometimes there's still that stigma. There's still that I don't know what to do, or I feel like I'm a bad mom. And so I'm still doing that same education that I was doing years ago, which tells me, you know, we still have work to do.
There's always new babies being born and new mothers being born.
Yes, it is. Right? Yes, it is. And we know that there's a correlation between depression and infant mortality. And when moms can't take care of themselves, they can't take care of the babies. And so one of the results that we've seen with the connection and the collaboration we've had with agencies is that before we started the Franklin County Depression Task Force, 1 in 4 of our moms were rated high for depression in their postpartum. Now we have 1 in 8. So we have made significant progress with our in-home counseling for our mom. But yet, as Tanya indicated, we still have a far way to go.
Well, you still have poverty.
We do, yes.
I mean,
yes,
yes. How do you, yes. How, I mean, to what extent does poverty play into this and your success at eradicating this problem?
It's huge, and that's one of those things. When you talk about the social determinants of health, you talk about one of those issues of poverty, one of the things to access of care, access to fresh fruits, access to anything that will alleviate any of those things for you to have healthy birth outcome. And the challenge is there when you pull, you think about the first thing is how I'm going to provide for my immediate need versus how am I going to get to a prenatal care right now. So that then become a secondary thing. And then we see the gap increasing between black and white rates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us any stories about someone that really sticks out in your mind as someone who's benefited from this program now?
Oh, yeah, we have several. One of the things we have done is that I can tell you about several of our moms. We right now employed our moms, empowering them also and removing them out of poverty, so also make them testimony of the program. There's no better person that would tell about the services of the program and be a recruitment than a mom who has received services, who is in there. And so I can think about a mom that is working with us currently. She was in her 30s when she had her first child. And she looked us up on the internet, found our resources, and called. And she was enrolled in a program and new to this, and she had to learn. And so she was assigned. One of the things about program is that our services are provided through public health nurses, social workers, and care coordinators. And so she was able to learn some what was expected, get to prenatal care early, what she should eat, her nutrition, looking at any of those things that will remove from having a healthy birth outcome.
Now, she called you.
She called.
What about people who you had to kind of drag in kicking and screaming a little bit? Any success stories there?
Yes. I think at first we do a lot of outreach, so we go out to...
Or you
to
had
see,
to bring pound, them break in. Down their door. Let's put it...
Well, our program is actually voluntary, so we really want women to come on their own, but we encourage them to come. And so we've had teenagers. One of the things that is not a good statistics for us is that our high teen rate on our caseload. It's about 33 right now. It was 36, so it is going down. So we're pleased with that. But our teenagers, when they come in to us and have a pregnancy, and I can tell you about two of them that started with us, and at first they didn't want to be in the program, and they felt that they knew everything about pregnancy and taking care of babies because they took care of their brothers and sisters, and they were enrolled in the program. And then afterward, during their pregnancy, their second trimester, we hired them into the program. And so they were able to learn and be trained on those things that cause infant mortality and be able to go out and recruit other women in the program.
While they were still pregnant.
While they were still pregnant and they were working. And so they worked with us part-time and they were recruiting out there. And they were very excited about that because they told us that I'm so glad now I've learned more that I didn't know and I can tell other women about infant mortality, about what to do to make sure they have a healthy birth.
And we know so much more now about the effectiveness of peer-to-peer influence.
Oh,
and,
yes.
Yeah, to have someone who looks like you, literally pregnant like you, it makes a big difference.
It does. In fact, they ask us to see if they can put a peer group together. And we do have a mom's peer group that meet monthly and support each other and share goodies, share supplies with each other. And so it's a good thing. Peer-to-peer has a strong influence.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's empowering for women to, as in Grace's program, learn the skills that they need. And, of course, in our program, learn to recover and then to go back and give back. Yes. And it's a silver lining of a struggle to be able to then share what you've learned mm-hmm. with someone that comes along behind you.
So your programs have been working together for how long now?
Well, we started, actually, the Franklin County Depression Task Force started in 2008, and our contract with PROM started in 2009.
Have you learned something that you take to POEM, you bring back to POEM from this relationship?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think a lot of meeting moms where they are and developing our mentor program has been integral because that came after mm-hmm. we got to know Caring for Two. Mm-hmm. And the understanding that while our support groups are important, being able to connect with moms. Can I text you? Can I give you a call? When can I give you a call? Finding out what works for them and being able to develop our programs based on that.
You've had success. What are your goals?
Well, our goal is to actually reduce infant mortality. When the program started in 2000, infant mortality rate in the 3 Columbus neighborhoods that we provide service for African-American women was 16.1. Currently, we are at around 15. And it takes a lot because it's a gradual and an incremental decrease. And we know we can do better. One of the things we know, we have seen that our mom entering to care has really increased from about 76% to 83%. So we're very pleased with that. Our preterm births have really decreased from 23% to 17% since 2005. So we're making headway, but we know there's still more and more women we need to meet. And the goal of our program is to be able to do that.
Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about it. Grace Kalisua, I hope I haven't butchered your name.
No, you did fine.
Okay. From the Columbus Public Health Project, Director of Caring for Two, and also Tanya Fulwider, Program Director of Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.